Do me a favor, see if there's no feedback, let me know that this is working properly. Okay, first of all, you're recording, right? We're on. But I hear slight feedback. Is it up too high? Make it a little lower. Today is August the 22nd, 2010. It's Sunday. It's our opening Shayur for the year. And Be'ezrat Hashem, I begin my 52nd year of teaching Torah. So let me begin with the traditional tefillah. You hear it. Somu fanecha Adonai Elohai shelo yera davar takhalal yadi v'lo et kasher b'dva halacha v'yismachu bi chaverai v'lo amal tamei tahar v'lo al tahar tamei v'lo yikashlu chaveri b'dva halacha v'yismach b'hem. And I don't think there's a more beautiful prayer that expresses our feeling. Now, I also want to mention, I want to dedicate today's Shayur. I was very moved. I had read about this Jamaican Negro, I don't know what term to use, it's a bad term today, but he was not an Afro-American, he's from Jamaica, and how he came to Yiddishkeit all on his own. His name, Yosef Robinson. And I read about he works in Midwood in a liquor store, and people should go in and say hello to him. And I saw his picture on the website, and I just learned that he was killed in a holdup last Thursday. That he was killed in a holdup last Thursday in the liquor store in Midwood. So I tell you, my heart is broken. In Midwood already, it's supposed to be a nice area. It's between Borough Park and Flatbush. So let me dedicate today's Shayur in memory of Yosef Robinson. If I understand correctly, he has not yet been buried. Now, the Milei de Bedichat, I'll leave for the end of the Shayur. I want to get involved and bring you into what we're doing. The story of the Sunday class has a long background. It goes back to a conversation with Rabbi Yehuda Koopman of Michalar in 1970-71, where he asked me to do something unique that would combine both Torah learning as personified by a Rosh Yeshiva and would give ample feeling to someone who has a doctorate in Jewish history. And I got involved in teaching responsa literature, and over the years it became all-consuming and overwhelming. And what we have in the Kollel on Sunday is a 20-year or so, perhaps it's more already, ongoing course in response to literature. Now, you're at the tail end of many years, it's about 6 years already, that I've covered the Holocaust from the 30s into the 40s and 50s in response to literature. And you're at the very tail end, and we're picking up with a topic that you can walk right into. It's a topic that was never really widely discussed before the post-Holocaust period. And as far as I know, this was the only time in rabbinic literature where it became a major issue. And that is the question of Agunim. All of you know about Agunot. Agunot is an issue that haunts us. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pages have been written on being Matir Agunot. All of you are sitting today in the Kollel of Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, and also let me say hello, besides the students in front of me, let me say hello to the, I would imagine, I humbly say this, the thousands that are listening across the world in so many different institutions of Torah, coming from Litvisha backgrounds, Hasidic backgrounds, etc. So let me say hello to you as well. But to the students in front of me, you're sitting in the Kollel of Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, the Jerusalem branch of Reitz. And who was Reitz? Who was Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector? And Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector was world famous as the Avi Agunot. He wrote 5 Svarim of Shelet and Shuvot. He was Matir, literally thousands upon thousands of Agunot. Of course, he not only dealt with individual cases, he dealt with cases where both sank on the way to America, and you had hundreds of Agunot as a result of the sinking of that particular boat. And it was Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan who was Matir, and some of you may or may not recall that about 15 years ago, we spent about 2.5 years on the classic Agunot. Now, that's not to be confused with the contemporary problem of Agunot, because today we have a problem which we'll address time and again in 1,000 different ways, mainly in our Monday class, but all of us live in two worlds. There is no one in this room who lives in only one world. Ger v'tosha v'nochi machem, as the Rav always said, and we live in the Torah world and in the Western world. At times our values are destroyed by the Western world. And of course in the Western world, I was just talking with a very important person who in his lifetime has given tens of millions of dollars that stuck, if not more, occupied very important positions, and he's not well today, and he was so depressed. Some of the news in the Torah world with robberies and thievery and other problems of a sexual nature, and I had to encourage him. I had a quote to him just a half hour ago, what keeps me going, what Rabbi Rubin and I heard from Rabbi Dr. Leo Young, 6 words that saved our lives. Judaism is perfect, Jews are not. So part of the Western world, with the stress on money, men today hold up their wives when they're in the middle of a divorce process, they hold them up for money. That is not the classic aguna, that is a man-made or self-inflicted aguna. But now we have a different problem whatsoever. After World War II, we have for the first time tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of agunim. And this brings us to the whole question of a man. Can he be an agun? What laws apply to him? Now, all of you know that according to the Torah law, and the feminists have made a major case out of this against Torah, according to Torah law, a man can have more than one wife. Now, I have to tell you in advance, I'm not here to justify it, I'm not here to explain it, I'm not here to use homilies. When we said Naseh v'nishma, we surrendered to a Torah system. And that is part of the Torah system. I, the modern mind, has difficulty understanding it, because in the Western world, men and women are exactly the same, men and women are equal, double ring ceremonies, and all that goes with it. And I already see in our circles, men are walking around with wedding bands on their fingers. So we have been influenced by the Western world, but we are B'nai Torah, and this is the Torah system. I can explain that, I can go into details, it's not for now. But it could be that this is the nature of the beast, that a man needs more than one wife, a woman needs only one husband. It could be, but that's not for now. This is the halacha. Now, time marched on, and I'm repeating part of the last year just to bring the newcomers up to par. Time marched on, Mendel and Rabbeinu Geshem came along and introduced the cherem that you can only have one wife. David just got married. The cherem does not apply to him because his father is Turkish. He descends from Reb David Pardo, the Chasdei David, and being anyone else here who's from the Eidot HaMizrach. So three of you, the cherem doesn't apply to you. Rabbeinu Geshem had nothing to do with you, and you can eat rice on Pesach, and you can have more than one wife. But time marched on, and even in these Eidot HaMizrach communities, they didn't develop a cherem, but they developed a shvuah. And if you will look into the ketuvah that your great-grandparents signed, or the ketuvah, and trace it historically, you will find that in 99% of Sephardic marriages in the 18th century, the 19th century, and into the 20th century, the Sephardim, the males, swore they would not marry another woman unless their wife gave them permission. Okay? You're aware of that. So the Ashkenazim have a problem with the Chemer Rabbeinu Geshem, and gradually even the Eidot HaMizrach introduced into the Ketuvah the Shvuah. And I want to tell you, I saw a display at the Yeshiva University Museum. I believe it just came to the Israeli Museum. They're setting it up, a display of illuminated manuscripts, including Ketuvot. And among the Sfarei Ketuvot, you'll see that the Rebbe is not putting you on. That mamish, it says, v'hinei nishpa, I take an oath, and I will not marry anyone else without my wife's permission. Of course, in the modern world, there are laws of bigamy in every civilized country, so that a man can't have more than two wives, nothing to do with the cherem, nothing to do with the oath, but dinah d'malchut the dinah. And this is in most countries in the world. I don't know about the Arab countries, but certainly in America and Canada and Britain and in Russia and in Poland and in Germany, there is a law about bigamy, so that having more than one wife becomes a total prohibition. Not so much because of the Torah, but because the Torah gives us the concept where it is not a ritual, dinner de malchuta dinner. And some of you may recall, many years ago, I spent an entire year on those three words, dinner de malchuta dinner, and what it means. Okay, fine. Gentlemen, in the state of Israel, the cheirum was renewed by the chief rabbinate, and here it applies both to Sfatim and both to Ashkenazim.
What date
did they have? About 1950, 50-51. It was renewed, and in the state of Israel, no one is allowed to have more than one wife. Here the state law is, and this is obviously considered halacha here, if you come in with more than one wife, you don't have to divorce the second wife. And I can tell you, when we came in Aliyah back in 69, they were settling Ramat Eshkol. Now, we're one of the few families that came then and did not go to Ramat Eshkol, although there was an apartment held for us, and the Jewish agency thought for sure, we're off the wall, we think we're going to live elsewhere, all the olim are going to go to Ramat Eshkol. So many of my friends went to Ramat Eshkol, and we got to know them very well, got to know the area, and there was one family there that came from Iran, Persia, and he came with two wives. And we always had a problem because they were nice people, fine people, frum people. How do you invite them to a simcha? You're making a wedding. How do you invite them? Mr. Persia and his harem, Mr. and Mrs. and Mrs. Persia. How do you write the invitation? But that's the law. We don't force them to divorce. Now, I want to say something in parentheses that you may or may not realize the depth of what I'm saying, and I don't have time to elaborate, but I have elaborated in the Monday course a number of years ago. Happiness is a function of society. Now, what do I mean by that? Don't laugh at people that have more than one wife. Why is it when David just got married and the Matan was at the wedding and Ariel, why is it that Ariel will not entertain the thought of allowing David to marry another woman as well? Why? My wife, your wife? Because that's the way they were raised. Yeah, right? We were raised. The first thing I do in the morning after I daven and I start learning and I come to Gris and I do some mitzvah here, I go to the Yankee website. Why do I go to the Yankee website? Yitzchak goes to the Red Sox website. Why? He was raised in Boston. I was raised in New York. You know, when I read the Yankees won, somehow the little kid in me is happy. If the Yankees lost, the little kid in me is sad. So we were raised that way. Why do we love? Why does Rakefet say, you know you've lived in Israel too long when you love Tirat Zvi Pastrami instead of Shmulka Bernstein? You don't know what Shmulka Bernstein is. Instead of Rubishov, whatever, whoever's making Rubashkin, whatever's going on in America today. American pastrami, oh my gosh, you'd give your tongue for it years ago. Today, I've lived in Israel too long, I don't touch that garbage, it can kill you. But Tirat Zvi, turkey pastrami, healthy, good. So you see, happiness is a function of the way you grew up, what you're used to. And don't think that people who had two wives were unhappy. The wives loved it, they were used to this lifestyle. It meant the man always had someone to make supper for him. One woman would help another woman. Okay, this was life. Now, I'm not going to repeat it now, but I just tell you the last shiur we gave last year was Eben Ezra, Siman Aleph, Sif Chaf Aleph, Sif Katan Chaf Aleph in the Eben Ezra. And there you go into great detail about the Chelem, the Rabbeinu Geshem. We went through every word. And what you see is very simply that even though the Sfadim took on some of the Chumras, they were much more lenient than the Ashkenazim. And to give you a classic example, in two modern times in Israel, including the 50s, into the 60s, it didn't change until the 70s. Yibum was a choice. In other words, if Chas v'Chalila, your brother died without children, if your wife gave you permission, you were miyabing your sister-in-law. In the Ashkenazic world, this has not been heard of for hundreds and hundreds of years. We paskin lahalacha, we do chalitza, we do not do yibum. For many reasons, but this is the halacha. The Sfadim were much more mekel. By the 1970s, the pressures of modernity, of living together, being in Israel together, ultimately the Sfadim today cannot do Yibum, they too have to do Chalitza. And there may be many reasons. I can just throw out one simple thought. We're living in a world that's oversexed. I don't have to tell you the world in which we live. I don't have to tell you the way women dress during the summer. I walked around the streets of New York this summer. I thought it was at the beach. So we're in a world that's oversexed, and it hits away at us, hits away. If Chas v'Chalila, a man could marry his sister-in-law, Hashem Yirachem, what type of peccadillos would come out of it?
So, what happens if we say Chalitza because the brother's only 3 years old?
You know that that's the halacha, and you know that the feminists go crazy, and you know that we don't have a solution. This is the halachic system. Your mind has to work the way the Rav's mind worked. Okay? And you sat with the Rav in Boston. Let him influence you. A Western gentleman, but surrender to the halacha. But of course, what we try to do in a case like that, if we can puzzle out the condition, you have to be able to see what happened, how she got married, etc., etc., to relieve her of the need of chalitza. But if you can't, you have to wait. Ein breira. We have no choice. Now, coming back to chalitza, this is a perfect example. Now, I'll say a few words about the rub. If you want more, because this was caught up in controversy, and I have a footnote on it in my work on my Rebbe, the Rav felt very strongly that we cannot have a Heta Meir Rabbanim in the year 2011, where we are today. Mendel, are we in 2011? Did the Rebbe make a mistake, or did the Rebbe know what he was talking about 1 second ago? What do you think?
No?
Let me tell you. You don't open your mouth if you're a Talmud Chacham without thinking what the results are 1 year from now. Eisa hu chacham, haro'et hanolad. So as far as we're concerned, this is 2011. So the Rav felt very strongly. The Rabbeinu Geshem left an opening. What was the opening? That in case 100 different Rabbanim in 3 different locations feel the Cherem should not apply, they can sign a Heta Meir Rabbanim. And I have to tell you, the Rav was opposed. I quote Rebbe, I quote him in my book, I give the exact source, where the Rav said that nowadays we have to have symmetry. We can't allow a man any more privileges than a woman. If she can't remarry, he can't remarry. And the Rav felt very strongly about it. I want you to know that a Talmud of the Rav out of the 70s, when Rabbi Wurzburg of published in Tradition, all this is in a footnote in my book, you can get all the sources. When Rabbi Wurzburg of Published in Tradition, quoting the Rav, Rabbi Sauer of Los Angeles attacked Rabbi Wurzburger that it's impossible the Rav could have said this. So I have to tell you, takes went into the public domain, and sure enough, there's the Rav saying it syllable by syllable, word by word. And that's exactly what happened in Israel, that in today's society, we cannot afford the luxury of a man marrying his sister-in-law. God forbid, if we allow this type of relationship, God knows what it will do to the family unit. And this became par for the course. The only time, basically, we rely upon a Hetamei Rabbanim or in the State of Israel, it's done with the permission of the two chief rabbis, is if a woman goes out of her mind. And I've seen cases like that where she's not a bar dat, meaning she cannot accept the get. Once a woman can't accept the get, the man is left without a wife. So there, we allow him to give a get, leave it in the hands of Beis Din, we allow him to give a shtachit chayvut that he will provide for his wife if she recovers, and we permit him to remarry. Again, before Rabbi Rubin shoots a question at me, I'm well aware that the feminists have jumped upon this halacha as being unfair, but my response is, this is the Torah system, and if we can help the man, we want to help the man. Halavai, we can help the woman. But if the man goes insane, we have a tremendous problem. And this is what I told you time and again, that my daughter tells me that in the rabbinic courts, my eldest daughter, who was the first woman in the history of our people to pass all the exams in Eben Ezra and Choshen Mishpat and get chasmacha, authorization from the chief rabbinate to be a female rabbinic lawyer. So my daughter tells me that the rabbinic courts followed the psak of Nehemiah Goldberg, Zalman Nehemiah Goldberg, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, son-in-law, a great Lamdan, that if the man can just say Kriyat Shema, that shows he's a bar dat, and he can give a get. Now, following the Holocaust, we have tens of thousands of men, just as there were tens of thousands of women who didn't know what happened to their husbands, tens of thousands of men who didn't know what happened to their wives. The Rabbanim were overwhelmed. I have to tell you, those of you who have studied the period, to a certain degree I lived the period, the questions were by the thousands, if not the tens of thousands, men, women. Women is very serious, because if chas v'chalila you make a mistake and you permit the woman to remarry and her first husband comes back, you have a terrible case of Mamzeret on your hands. And as you read in yesterday's Pasha, Lo Yavo Mamzer B'Kal Hashem, Gam Da Asiri, even the 10th generation, Mamzeret is self-perpetuating, and there's no solution. It's not like you can say, wait 2 generations, wait 3 generations. It's a terrible, horrendous stigma. So that when it came to women, I spent so many lectures on the response of literature many years ago when I dealt with the classic Arguna, and you had to bring testimony, you had to bring proof. It had to be looked into very carefully. In addition, I mentioned this last May when we completed the Shayurim, times were different. Today you're living in a computer generation. You don't appreciate how you grew up with the computer. As someone who's lived before the computer and sees the computer in action, you got to remember, today you can draw up lists from all over the world, everyone can put names in. Following World War II, there were endless lists of survivors that were circulating. There were lists of Hayas, lists of the Jewish Agency, lists of the Red Cross, lists that came out of the displaced persons camps. Add to this the communist world. Again, I'm talking to a new generation. Yitzhak and I know what communism was about. You don't. The communist world put up an iron curtain. Ein yotzei ve'ein nichnas. And you had hundreds of thousands of survivors behind the Iron Curtain. Go and figure out who is alive and who is dead. And these were tremendous problems. Now, with the man, it's not as great a risk as with a woman. With a woman, your tremendous fear is, God forbid, if you make a mistake. And remember, heteraguna is based upon lack of knowledge. When a rav, you're a rabban, when you're going to paskin a shaila, a woman's going to come to you. I just saw a shaila in America, sitting with Gedolei Yisrael. The wife was serving us, it was Shabbos, and the junk splashed on the hot water pot. And the whole outside was covered with stains of meat. Okay, you know what the shaila is, you know what the facts are. You see in front of you, you have a woman who has a shaila in Tarek Mishpacha. Okay? She brings medical examination, she brings papers. You know, you see, you have to decide. Aguna is based upon, you don't have tangible evidence. If you had tangible evidence, you would know whether the man is dead or whether the man is alive. It's based upon circumstantial evidence. You can always be wrong. V'hayu ma'asim me'olam. The greatest Rabbanim made mistakes. How many of you are familiar with the Megillat Sefer, with Rabbi Yaakov Emden, with his autobiography, where he talks about, I believe it was his grandfather, who they thought for sure was killed during the Khmelnytsky massacres? His grandmother, and you can correct me if I'm skipping a generation or going back a generation, and his grandmother got a heter to remarry, and then her first husband came back, thank God, before she remarried. So there were always mistakes made. I can tell you after World War II, it's not the time to go into it, but I've given many shiurim on women who remarried, had children, and then their first husbands came back. So you're dealing here with women, it's a pachad, and yet you can't say, I'm not going to paskin. You have hundreds of thousands of women. You have to rebuild the Jewish people. Some of you may be sitting here only because your grandmother or great-grandmother got a heter to remarry. Some of the people listening in positive that this is correct. What are you going to do? Now, with men, it's less of a problem. Because what's the worst that can happen? So you made a mistake. So he has two wives. There's no Issa D'Oraita. There may not even be an Issa D'Rabbanan because it was all B'Shogeg. But you have to admit, it's a terrible, horrendous human tragedy that a man remarries, has four or five kids with his second wife, and then his first wife meets around the street. She survived. So it's not to be dismissed lightly. Halachically, it's not as earth-shaking as an aguna, but from the point of view of human emotion, you cannot dismiss this lightly. And I'm going to show you today, your mind will be blown by what I've uncovered. Now, the person who wrote the most famous tribute on it was Reb Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog. Reb Herzog was the second chief rabbi of the state of Israel. A lot can be said about Reb Herzog. I don't want to take off time now to describe his life, but I'll only make one point to you. What's amazing about Reb Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, he is autodidactic. He was raised Gil in Paris, where his father was the Rav of the shul that later was called the Haredi shul in Paris. He studied with his father. He corresponded with the great rabbi in Schlutz, the Ribbaz, whom he considered his Rebbe, although he never studied with him on a personal level. But he met him when the Ribbaz came to Paris to raise funds for the publication of his Yerushalmi, which is a Yerushalmi that many of you use today. And he was autodidactic. He married the daughter of Rav Shmuel David Hillman, the Av Beis Din of the London Beis Din, and he studied in London, went on to get a master's, a doctorate, many doctorates. He had a doctorate in marine biology. He had a jurisprudence doctorate. He spoke something like 9, 10 different languages fluently. The man knew all of Shas. He was considered the greatest Bucky in the state of Israel. Everyone came to his house Friday. He would give his shiur and study together with Rabbi Orbach and Rabbi Yashiv, and all the future Gedolim of Yerushalayim would come to study with Rav Herzog. If you look at pictures of the man when he was elected chief rabbi, brought from Ireland, where his chief rabbi of Ireland brought to Israel in 1937, his beard was black. If you look at pictures just 12, 13 years later, he looks like he aged 50 years within 13. Why? The tragedy of the Holocaust, what he went through, the building of the State of Israel, the shyness he had to deal with, and he was one of a kind. On a personal Reitz note, when he died in 1959, the chief rabbi of the State of Israel was offered to my Rebbe on a golden platter. Ben Gurion came to see the Rav, pleaded with the Rav, others pleaded with him, but the Rav did not accept the chief rabbinate. In 35, when Rebbe stood as one of three candidates for the chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv, he lost the election. What's fascinating about 35, there were three candidates for the Tel Aviv chief rabbinate. The Rav, a youngster at the time, Rabbi Herzog, who was chief rabbi of Ireland, and Rabbi Amiel, who was the chief rabbi of Antwerp in Belgium. And the Rav's cousin, uncle, Mayor Berlin, said about the election, I quote this in a footnote, but it's absolutely so that he said it. He said there were three candidates. The Rav, my relative, was the greatest London. Rav Herzog was the greatest tzaddik. But Rav Amiel haya hachi matim. He was the one in the prime of Meir, fabulous speaker. He was the one that was matim. How do you say that in English? That was most fitting in pasik, in Yiddish supplement pasik. But you don't know Yiddish. What word would you use then? What word?
Compatible.
Compatible is not strong enough. He was the one that was the best at that moment for Tel Aviv. Okay, now, I'm quoting, and part of this I quoted last year, and then I'm moving into new material. Rav Herzog was published, in his own lifetime, he published very little. He was caught up with, as I said, World War II and War of Independence. Following his death, they published Teichal Yitzchak. There's one volume, Or HaChaim. There are two volumes, Evan HaEzer. Later, after his son was president of the State of Israel, money was raised and money was dedicated, and they published something like 10 volumes of all his writings and republished what had been published earlier. So I'm quoting from Psakim Uktavim, the sixth volume, Sheilatu Tshuvat B'dinei Evan HaEzer, published in 1995. I'm quoting from Siman Chet. What's fascinating is who he's writing this tshuva to. The famous, the world famous Gaon, Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky. Fellas, do you know about Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky? He was a Litvish Gaon. He was the Rav of Slutsk. He was arrested by the communists, sent off to jail. There was a tremendous international outcry. They got him out of jail. It was about 1926. The communists exiled him out of Russia. Britain allowed him to come in, and he became the Av Beitin of the United Synagogue based in Great Britain, the Av Beitin of the Beitin, which functions out of London until today. And he was a Gaon Adir. Some of you are familiar with his work on the Tosefta, Chazon Yecheskel. It's one of the classic rabbinic works on the Tosefta. And this was Rabbi Chatzkel Abramsky. His final years he spent within walking distance of here. He moved into Bayit Vagan and he lived to a... He was still giving shayurim in his 90s. He would go to Panovich once a week, give shayur there. He was Toseis, alive and kicking, well into his 90s. I think the only child left alive, if anyone here is from England, you can correct me, I believe he has a son in London who was a professor. I believe he's the only child that is still alive, but he has many grandchildren, etc. Now, Rav Chatzkel turns to Rav Herzog and he wants to know what to do with the problems of all these men who have come to England and want to remarry. And it's a very fascinating tshuva, summarizing a good deal of what I just have said orally, that with women we have to be very careful. There's the terrible problem of eshet ish. However, with men, what we have to worry about is Cheirim d'Rabbi Nageshem and the government law of bigamy. So it's not that we can give wholesale cheterim to men to remarry. And we have to look in. Each man who wants to remarry has to come and tell us his story. Now, here you get involved with a very interesting halachic... this is one of the most fascinating topics in halacha. It goes back to the last part of the 13th century, and there was a boat that sunk off the coast of Italy. This she'ela of the widows that were left because their husbands never came back was brought to the attention of Rebbe Elazar Meir Verdun, who was one of the last of the Baalei Tosfot. And there are various versions, whether it's at the end of 4 years or 7 years, but he gave a heter for the women to remarry, and he said if they haven't heard from their husbands by now, they are missing and presumed dead. Now, this concept of missing and presumed dead is something very new to the halacha. Again, I can't go into the whole sugya, it's in Yevamah. Believe me, when you finish smicha and start learning, because Rav Kefet always says smicha is a license to start learning. Tremendous sugya there. And you see, there too, the sugya seems to imply, logically, many times we should be able to a woman to remarry, because logic tells us the man is dead. But we are worried. God forbid, the one in a million, Yonah in the world, what we call halachically under the rubric, Mayim She'en Lahem Sof. Who knows what's going on in the whole ocean? So we go out of our way to check. We just can't permit on the basis of assumption. And here, along comes Rabbi Elazar Meir Verdun, and he says on the basis of an assumption, he is willing to permit the women to remarry. Because he's logical. He says, look, it's a rove. 4, 7 years have gone by. The men have not come back. Fine. All the other Rishonim dismiss Reb Elazar Meir Verdun. But it remains a viewpoint. And in the 1800s, his viewpoint was resuscitated. Because in the 1800s already, the world becomes smaller. We have what the Chatam Sofer talks about, other postmen talk about, Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan talks about. We have a postal system. We have telegrams. We have telephones. We have International Red Cross. Imagine today you have the email, direct communication. It's an unbelievable world today. So that if a man hasn't come back, and we know that he was on a plane that went down, on a boat that sank, a battlefield where there were no survivors, so that's a rove. It's one rove. Then we have a second rove, Reb Elazar Meir Verdun. If he would still be alive, he would have contacted his wife by now. You with me, Gil? That's the second majority. I've written a great deal on this. I don't want to confuse you with my writings. I'm not here to. I don't sell my own books, so don't be frightened. The Rebbe's driving you crazy.
Are they available?
Rakofer Aron, Chelik
Be. The Silver Era?
Silver Era and Rabbi and Bernard Rebbe will be available. The new book, I'm signing a contract, it's Rat Hashem within 2 weeks. Everything worked out. Thank God. Ani Modeh LaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the contract. At that time, I'll have a date of publication. What they intend to do, because it's a co-publisher, it's the OU and an Israeli publisher, what they intend to do is afterwards reissue a fourth edition of Rebel, a fourth edition of Silva. So Be'ezrat Hashem, by the end of this year, academic year, all my 6-7 books at that time should be in print. Okay? But what I'm talking about now, I wrote in great detail that appears in Rakafaran and Chelik Bet on my entry on Rav Yitzchok Yochanan Spekta. And there you'll have all the sources on what I'm talking about, the double majority, Rav Lezer Meir Vadun, the resuscitation of him. He plays a major role. You look into Rav Moshe Feinstein, there isn't a posek alive in the 20th century who Rav Avadya Yosef, who didn't utilize Rav Lezer Meir Vadun as the second robe or the second suffix. Trei Rubei, it's called, a Sveik Sveika, meaning the majority of people who were seen being led into the gas chamber perished. Had he survived, the majority of men who survived would have contacted their wives by now, 3 years after the Holocaust ended. You with me? Double majority. That's Reb Lezer Meir Vadun. So Rav Herzog says, when it comes to being mutter, a man to remarry, we perhaps can depend upon Reb Lezer Meir Vadun. We just need the assumption, the single majority. We don't need to. And when you have a case that people can testify, their wives were in a death camp. Their wives were being seen led to the gas chambers. And even though we know there were individual cases of men and women who ran away at the last minute, we see that now in the memoir literature that has come out. But if 3, 4, 5 years have gone by, this is a strong assumption. The women are dead. And he's writing this to Rav Abramsky. More than that, I just apologize. Next week I'll take attendance. I want to be sure you're going to honor me with your presence. I need more students. It's a terrible situation with this website, with what goes on today. I walked into the Shtiblum Borough Park where I'm davening 15 years. I spend at least a month, 5 weeks there every year. And I walk in and they're learning Daf Yomi as they always do, 6 o'clock in the morning. And they have a little mechanism on the table and the Rebbe is giving a shiur from the mountains. I said, thank God there's some people sitting and listening. I was afraid I'll walk in, I'll see the machshir of the guy speaking and 5 tape recorders around, you understand? They're MP3s, whatever you call them. And that's not fair to the Rebbe, because those thousands that are listening who can't be here have no choice. But if I don't have faces in front of me to interact, I have to buy gifts for David, for Matan, I'm finished. These guys are honoring me a second year with their presence. I'll owe them. I'll pay up. Believe me, I'll pay up. But remind me, I owe you by Hanukkah time. Okay. But I'll take attendance next week. And if you have that, I mean, I'm embarrassed. The guy tells me who studied, didn't miss a shiur of mine for the last. Says, I can't come to shiur this year. I have a serious chavrut time. What do you mean you have a serious chavrut? What am I teaching Narishkeit? I'm opening up windows of learning and thought that no other Rebbe is doing this. No, he has to learn Gemara. He can't leave the Gemara. It's a lifetime to learn Gemara. What, I don't learn Gemara? What do you think? We just finished. We got smicha, we stopped learning. I didn't know a thing when I got smicha. Yitzchak, how much did you know when you got smicha?
I'm embarrassed.
But we spent the rest.
How did it seem past me?
All right, I got an A. On my final exam by the Rav, which Rav Aaron Mark, I got an Aleph plus for Havana. To get that from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, I should only have a Refuah Shleima. Anyway, back here. Then Rav Herzog brings down another factor, which again is very important. He says, it's not a time to be machmir. Why? The future of the Jewish people is at stake. See, you don't understand the way we felt after World War II. How many survivors were there? How many children were there? Hitler killed minimum 1.5 million children. Do you know how many Jews there'd be in the world today? If we're not going to give Heterim to remarry, this is the future of the Jewish people are cut off. And he refers to this as a mitzvah derabim. And it can very well be when the future, now I gave shiurim on this years ago in a different aspect of the Holocaust, but when the future of the Jewish people hangs in the balance, we can very well say that Rabbeinu Geshem didn't make his cheirim under these circumstances. You all know that that's a clown in the Gemara, b'makom tzalo, gozri rabbanim. Time and again you'll see that kavod habriyot lo gozri rabbanim. You've learned Masechet Shabbat, you know what I'm talking about with rocks on Shabbos, like toilet paper. Chazal were making on many issues because ain goes from Gezerah tzibush and tzibicholim lamod bo. I mean, you can go on and on. There's so many different examples in Chazal. Allah hatama b'kami here. It's not a time l'chumra. We have to try our best because we're not going to have Jews left. And it could very well be, who would ever dream a time would come, Milta de lo shchichi, Rav Herzog says, that hundreds of thousands of men would be left without a wife? Rabbeinu Geshem never made his cherem under such conditions. And he goes on and on. But then he comes, halacha lemaisa. And here he's right on top of it. You can see his concepts of the Western world. Look, something we always have to be cognizant in the rabbinate. When you do something in public, people are going to learn, people are going to follow you. If you give one heter, it snowballs and becomes a heter for thousands. And this comes up, when I give you an example in Tarat Mishpacha, there's a whole machloiket when a woman is going to get AIH, artificial insemination husband. You're familiar with this. I gave Sherman this too many years ago. But anyway, you're familiar with this. AIH has solved tremendous halachic problems for us. One of the problems that comes up already in the end of the 19th century, we already see it in response to literature, is a woman who cannot conceive because she observes Tarat Mishpacha. What does that mean? All of you know that Tarat Mishpacha is built upon a normative situation where, generally speaking, where a woman goes to mikvah on the 12th, 13th day, she can conceive at that time. Imagine a woman who has a cycle that is different and she can conceive. For her, it's normative. She can conceive only on the 7th, 8th day. Well, you have a tremendous problem here. Because she observes mikvah, she can't have a child. This is a tremendous problem. In modern times, we solved the problem with artificial insemination. Husband, Shaarei Tzedek, is one of the leaders in the field of solving this problem, where they give her AIH. Now the question is, should she go to mikvah before the AIH? You follow the question? She's not going to live with her husband. But just the idea of being impregnated and getting the semen that is her husband's, maybe she should go to mikvah. And remember, there's a Zohar.
Does she talk Shiva?
We're not choshish for zava gedola here. You follow? But it doesn't matter. She can go to mikvah. She stops seeing. The period is over. We'll deal with her as a needed deoraita. She's going to mikvah to be yotzei the zohar that is masbuta. It's hard to translate that, but it's something very not nice, something putrid. If she gets her husband's semen while she has not gone to mikvah, so you should know it's a machleket poskim, and many poskim say chas v'chalila she should go to mikvah because and Reb Moshe poskim this way. Why? Because if the word gets out, a woman went to mikvah without observing Shivinikiyam, you follow me? You'll have the whole world being makil. Reb Moshe Hat Gazak, Reb Moshe said, Reb Moshe did this. Everyone is looking for it. Everyone is looking for kula. You have to be very careful. So Rav Herzog says that if we're matir, the woman, the men rather, to remarry, you cannot do it in a wholesale fashion. Don't get up in public and say, every man who has a problem, who hasn't seen his wife, who suspects that she died in the Holocaust, can remarry. You have to take each individual case. You have to go into the details. You have to see what the status is. You have to have a beit din, and then you can be matir. Now, he requires, and this is extremely important, that once the man gets a heter, he has to sign a shtar chayvut with the beit din, that if his first wife will come back, number one, he will give her a get. Number two, he will provide sustenance for her, that she won't have to come back and be a charity ward, a charity case. Very fascinating.
Who writes the get? The Beit Din, the
author? Well, it's interesting. Originally, Rav Herzog said the best idea would be to write the get and leave it in escrow with the Beit Din. But he recognized it may be too hard for the Beit Din. So if that's the case, instead of writing 10,000 gittin, you leave her hasha'ah, an authorization for the Beit Din in case the woman comes back. Okay, very interesting point. Watch. Watch. Comes up with another question. And this question, I don't know how it was finally resolved, but I find this so fascinating because of the era which I grew up. When I went to yeshiva, elementary school, yeshiva Salanta in the Bronx, the only yeshiva in the Bronx, yeshiva Rabbeinu Yisrael Salanta, today it's part of many conglomerations, it's SAR Academy, Salanta, Akiva, Riverdale, 3 day schools combined. Believe me, there is no resemblance between SAR Academy and what yeshiva Salanta was like 60, 70 years ago. So, you know, teachers had rulers beat the hell out of you, etc., etc. No correlation. Well, for good and for good. There's good and there's also Salanta. No, there was no good to getting clap, but then again, we had later the Shanghai crowd, and that's why Yitzhak and I are sitting here. We are products of Mr. Semple Sugihara Zeifet Tzadik Levracha. Our Rabbeim who put us on the path of Torah were the Altamirans who came to America and needed Panasa, wound up teaching in Salanta and wound up teaching in Maimonides. Now, I had kids in my class whose mothers were not their real mothers. Their mothers were their aunts. So Mendel, you wonder, how can this be? It's very simple. Today, thank God, childbirth is not so dangerous. Although last year we had a case in the Kollel where the woman did have problems. So every once in a while we get a shocking reminder of what childbirth was. A percentage of women died in childbirth. The custom in Eastern Europe was, if a woman died in childbirth, a younger sister would marry the widower and raise the children. Because it was felt, and quite obviously, that a stepmother may not love the children as much as a sister, as much as an aunt. So you all know that you can't marry two sisters, but that's only when the sister's alive. After her death, the prohibition does not apply. So Narav Herzog says, I've also been asked the question of whether a survivor from the Holocaust can marry his former wife's sister. And here too, he says, here too you can understand why he's being asked this question and why a man would want to marry his wife's sister, because a man is a strange animal. The BBC, about 10, 15, 20 years ago already, put out a tremendous series, Why Man Falls in Love, Why Is He Attracted to the Woman That He's Attracted to. And I don't have to tell you, I've had students who are handsome like movie stars, and they bring home a colleague, look at her, you know, gee, she's nothing to look at. You have girls that are beauties, they bring home a chatan, and they, you know, he's nothing to look at. And yet, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder, we all know that. And men, they can't explain it. The BBC could not come up with it. I don't want to go into more details because part of it is not exactly Lashon Nikiya, but a man, each one is different, each one has a certain attraction. And I've seen in life, you set a guy up with a girl, the girl tells him drop dead, but he likes the girl, find another girl that looks like that girl, and it'll click. And I've seen that happen much more than once. So if you fell in love with the sister, what could be better than marrying her sister who survived? So Rav Herzog writes, he has a long kundris, but he's not yet ready to publish it because the time is not yet ripe. Hold on 1 second, I'll take the question in 1 second, Gil. You know what I think he means? It was too soon. He wanted to wait until a good 5, 6, 7 years went by. This tshuva is not dated, unfortunately. In order to marry a sister, let's be absolutely certain the first sister is dead. It's not just having two wives, it's incest if the first sister comes back. So I have a feeling he wrote it Shuvah LaHakel, but he was not yet ready to publish it. If anyone knows whether this Shuvah was actually published, I'd appreciate learning. I have not been able to find it. Yes, Gil?
If he's going to be making on that at all, why wouldn't he be Mikil Paraguno? It's the same on there, wouldn't it be? If there's a shot that woman comes back.
Oh, you're saying, you're saying it's incest. So, yeah, besides, with Aguna, you would put together Trey Roubaix. I mean, in other words, but he's hesitant here because there's now wholesale cases that they're going to be matir. This you cannot be matir wholesale. We have to wait. Give it more years. Let's be certain. This, you follow me? This takes on already a character of Aguna. You're right. But it's too soon. Aguna, they were matir. Thousands and thousands of cases. Well, you'll see. We'll get there. You'll see. Show you a document that will blow your mind. Now, in the same volume, I just quoted Siman Tet, and this is one Siman later. Right? I quoted Siman Chet. This is Siman Tet. Also had been published a number of times. I'm quoting from the latest publication. Here it's very fascinating, because here is a tshuva to the Sfadik chief rabbi, to Rav Ben Zion Chai Uziel. Now, Rav Uziel, again, you all know Rabbi Mark Angel wrote his doctorate, if I'm not mistaken, and Rabbi Uziel has published a great deal. Rabbi Uziel already was a London Mufak, was very broad and in general, following the Sfadic tradition, much more Mekil than the Ashkenazic Rabbanim. Interestingly enough, Rabbi Uziel, his family, part of it are Ashkenazim today. Weingarten. If you've heard the name Uzi Weingarten, Mayor Weingarten, they are, I believe it's great-grandchildren of Rabbi Uziel. In other words, his granddaughter married into a very elegant Ashkenazic family from Belgium. Rabbi David Weingarten winds up in America, later in Israel. Naming anything to you, Mayor Weingarten, a graduate of Machon Lev, back in America. Uzi Weingarten is a mismach of the yeshiva of Ritz, but I'm not certain he remained solid in his observance. Anyway, imagine he gets the question now from his co-chief rabbi, and they're dealing where there was testimony of women going into the gas chambers. And he says, here where you already have such strong testimony, it could very well be we can be mut here. And even the Sfadah custom, where they swear that they're not going to take a second wife without permission of the first wife, and to a certain degree, the Sfadah custom would make it harder than the Ashkenazic custom. Because the Ashkenazic custom is just the Cherem of Rabbeinu Geshem. So we can take the Cherem and say it doesn't apply here, B'makom tzal o gazu rabbanon, b'makom kritut am Yisrael, that the Jewish people are going to be cut off, lo gazu rabbanon. We can give so many different reasons why the cherem doesn't apply, but when a person took an oath, he can't take a second wife without the permission of his first wife. So it could be that it's a little harder. You see, here it's reverse. That the Ashkenazim, it's only a cherem. But the Sfadim putting their ketuvah, an absolute shvua. But Rabbi Herzog says that it cannot be that when a person takes an oath, you have to know what was on his mind. All of the Nedarim and shvua go according to Lo Dibra Torah V'Lashon B'nei Adam. The way a person thinks, he says, when a person takes an oath, it never dawned upon him that he's taking an oath that in case Hitler comes to power and the women will go into gas chambers and we don't know whether they're alive or dead, he never in a million years dreamt that he should remain an agun, that under those conditions he should not be able to remarry. And therefore, he takes the oath, but it doesn't apply in these circumstances. And he feels that Rav Uziel can be matir for the Eidot HaMizrach, that just as we can wipe out the Cherem Rav Geshem, we can negate it, abrogate it in these circumstances, we can abrogate the Shvuah. The Shvuah was never meant for such a situation.
And you see, someone might ask,
yeah,
where does this come in? And they don't realize, they'll say in Greece or the island of Rhodes.
Of course,
they
wiped out Jews. I can tell you further, my wife's brother married a Yerushalmit girl of Greek origins. So one time, her father comes home. This is a legendary story in the family. I knew her father. And he said, he is entitled to reparations. And everyone laughed at him. He said, no, my cousins were wiped out in Rhodes. Do you know that he applied, and they tell the story, it had to be about 65, 66, he walks in carrying a television set with the papers on the mortgage ripped up. He got reparations, paid off the mortgage, and bought a television set. I don't know what television they got then. It was before Israel started broadcasting, 68. Maybe it was as late as 68. But it was mamish right before we came in Aliyah. So of course the Sfadim had the same shaila. Not only there, there were communities in Serbia, etc. There are plenty of Sfadim there, plenty of Eidot HaMizrach people. Where Yitzhak Shamir came from, that whole area. No, it was a real question, not only for Ashkenazim. Now, here he goes into the whole problem, Reb Lesser Mirvadun, and what I told you about. He says if the Chacham Sofer already spoke about the post office, and Reb Yitzchok Chanan already spoke about telegrams, what can we say today when we have telephones and worldwide communication? But then he says, the fly in the ointment, Russia. Russia, tens of thousands of survivors, and how do we contact them? But he says, even with Russia, we have to approach them. The Jewish Agency has an office that deals with Russia. It takes avodah v'chachana, but he says, even with Russia, we can make progress. And therefore, he says, you have declared, Rav Uziel evidently wanted to declare, that you have to wait 12 months after the war has ended. And he says, it could be that 12 months is sufficient for men. But for women, I absolutely feel we have to wait another 12 months, give it 2 years, because everything is helter-skelter, and to be matir eshadish in 12 months' time, based upon avad zichro, it's too early, it's too soon. And he says, we should get together, call together 10 Bali Horam of Hakim, 10 of the great poskim in Israel, and we should reach agreement and give authorization and guidance to the rabbinate throughout the world. Now, fascinating line here. And again, I recall my Rebbe's memory. Gil, in my classroom, the Rebbe is right here next to me. Shouldn't make a mistake. Okay. Rebbe always used to speak about, had a lot of drasha, you know, tremendous dasha in addition to everything else. So I would speak about different types of Talmidei Chachamim, the difference between Chachma, Bina, Vidat. And you know, he would talk about Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim was very innovative mind, but Reb Chaim was not a posek. And whenever the Rav spoke about a posek, he would talk about Rav Yitzchok Chanan Spector. And the Rav told the story, I've told the story hundreds of times already, but if you haven't heard it, it's worth telling the story. That one time in Brisk, there was a get aguni. You know what a get aguni means? It's a very interesting expression. A man was on his way to America, Labriut. He was heading for Hamburg to sail. His wife didn't want to leave Europe for the obvious reason. America, your kids became Goyim. She stayed behind. Never. You know how many people stayed behind and were killed by Hitler? Didn't want to become Goyim in America. So he gave his wife a get. After the guy left Brisk, they saw there was a mistake in the name. I don't know what the mistake was. Nobody knows today. And they brought it to Reb Chaim, and he was mafalpil, and he called in the Brisker Dayan, Ripson, Chazalik, Regan. They were mafalpil, they went back and forth. And Reb Chaim finally says to the Brisker Dayan, send a letter to Reb Yitzchok Chanan Spector, write all the details, and ask him for a one-word telegram. Kasher pasul. The get is good, the get is invalid. So the Talmidim standing around Reb Chaim, Reb Simcha Zelek, and it was quite a based in Reb Leib Eisen was on the Beitin. What a Beitin they had in Brisk. They said to Reb Chaim, Rebbe, what's with you? Reb Yitzchok Chanan has written hundreds of tshuva. He wrote over 100, and if I'm not mistaken, looking from Arkla, about 161, 163 tshuva dealing with Aguna. Let him write you a tshuva. So Rav Chaim says, no, if he writes me a tshuva, no matter what he says, I'll see the other side. How do you say that in English? I will refute him. I will knock him out. But his word answer as a posek, I'm willing to take. And Rav Chaim, what he thought of his Chochamim, hears Rav Herzog speaking. He says, you'll say to me, why do we need 10 great poskim? What about Rav Yitzchok Chanan Spector, the great Rebbe of Kovna? He did it all alone? None of us can compare to Rav Yitzchok Chanan Spector. It's literally the words of the Rav here. Rav Herzog is saying it. Hu hayachad b'dorav mamash. He was the only one. He was one of a kind in his generation. V'chol g'dolei g'onei hadar yuponim elav. And everyone turned to him. And that's why he could do it alone. But what he could do alone, we need 10 Rabbanim. And he says it has to be handled carefully. It has to be handled slowly. We have to recognize the seriousness. Each case has to be done with on an individual basis. And he says, interesting, and he says, and I'll show you what the problem is. Not in every country were all the Jews wiped out. And he talks about France, where he grew up. More than 50% of the Jews were alive. Now, it's true, Poland was 90%, Holland was 82-83%. It's a terrible thing. The Dutch, the chief rabbi of Holland, refuses to go into the Anne Frank house. So they asked him why. He said, because the whole world comes to see the Anne Frank house, they walk out with the feeling that the Dutch population saved Jews. He said, they wiped us out, they collaborated, they gave names to the Nazis. It's a very insightful answer that he gave. But it's true, in France more than 50%. So you have to be so careful. Now, there's one other point here that's fascinating.
This was not an excuse to delay it?
No. He's just explaining why.
They had 10 rabbis.
There was Rav Kahana of the Old City was involved. There was Rav Tukachinsky. There was Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank.
Look,
you saw today there's a cheirim against Rav Moshe's granddaughter. Opening up Rivka Rappaport, that says she's married to the Sach Chavez great grandson. So she wants to open up a branch of her school in Ramat. They want to move the school to Ramat. So I saw in the Haredi press already, Haramim with so many signatures. Bar Shalom, not so hard even today.
What do they have against them?
What do they have against that? They're teaching general subjects and encouraging the boys to go into Tzva Haganah L'Yisrael. Could you imagine? Okay, don't bring our personal feelings into it, but you can get 10 Rabbanim together. Now, there's one other part here which is fascinating, and this tshuva that Rav Uziel was involved with was the Saloniki. And it seems that Rav Herzog sees from the letter that he got, it's Balabatan who are writing to Rav Uziel. There was no Rav in Saloniki. And therefore he says that you should see to it that the people who are getting involved in Saloniki know what they're doing. Because these are Balabatan. These are not Rabbanim. And if they're Balabatim, they're not Rabbanim, we have to worry they don't take the halacha that seriously. And this is why, if you go through Rav Herzog's Tshuvat in this area, time and again he proposed, if you don't have Rabbanim to handle it like they have in England, or in France at that time, we will handle it in Israel. Send all the cases unto us, give us all the details, we'll set up a Beit Din, and we will paskin it. Now, in Siman Yud, again, there's another question dealing with the same issue, except this time it's Rome, Italy, dealing with the Rav of Rome, Italy, Harav David Parto, not Pardo, but Parto. It could be it's a misprint. Or it's Pei Resh Aleph, Parto.
With a dollar? Or
no, with a tet.
From where? From Italy?
From Italy, from Rome.
Parto, the famous rabbinic
family, but do you relate? Bardo.
Maybe like farther back.
Say that, because maybe I'm worried it was so you'd say it's not a misprint. Okay, because, you know, the Aleph can be in the wrong place.
Yeah.
We discovered big Yichis last year. I discovered my own Yichis, and David discovered his Yichis, and we're now fighting who has bigger Yichis, but we'll leave that for some other time. Gentlemen, it's Baruch Hashem. It's been a big week for me. I was Masada Kedushin Monday night. My grandson got married, and I got big Yichis. I get big yichus to my granddaughters-in-law. So Baruch Hashem, I nimodel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, he gets a letter from Italy, and again, here too, it's exactly the same problem. And again, he takes exactly the same approach, that you have to set up a Beit Din, you can't do it chaplap, you can't do it one after another, you have to do it, they have to feel the seriousness of it. And again, he cautions that the men have to sign on the dotted line that they're leaving an authorization for the gittin, and they're leaving a shtar hitchayvut, so that the people, the women, if they come back, will not be in a position to go begging. Fine. Let me give you one more source for today, and then I'll come to the Milei B'Tichata. Who here is from England? Last year we had a Talmud from London, am I right?
Gold is green,
Hendon. This year we do not. Gentlemen, what was the rabbinic school that functioned in London for generations? It no longer functions?
Jews College,
exactly. It no longer functions because today anyone who wants higher education in Torah gets on a plane quicker than it takes you to go from Haifa to Jerusalem. You can fly from Heathrow to Lund. So Baruch Hashem, Israel today is the center, particularly for the European countries, because there's no sense having rabbinic schools there when you can come here and study with, you know, Gedolei Yisrael. Baruch Hashem, Jerusalem does not lack for Gedolei Yisrael. Jews College once was a very important institution. It had a professor, Hirsch Jacob Zimmels. He was a Yekki who wound up in Jews College, running away from Germany, and he was one of the unique, I would say, in his own personality, in his own writings, he was a synthesis between traditional learning and scientific Jewish scholarship. I trust you understand what I'm driving at. Are you familiar with any of his writings? For instance, he did a lot of research on Sfadim and Ashkenazim. It's one of his classic works. What are the differences between them in halacha? He did research on kishuv, on
really?
Yeah, magic in halacha, and chazal and their approach to it, and the medrashim and was there kishuv and what could they do? And you all know the mechatshvim of Paro, who emulated Moshe Rabbeinu, and he goes into all this with Bucky and Shasi, an amazing amount of knowledge. And he did others from too. He had outstanding volumes combining traditional learning and scientific learning. He left a manuscript when he died. He died in the mid-70s. A manuscript that was published after his death. His son put it together. It's a very fascinating manuscript. It was the first volume in English dealing with this very topic. The name of the volume, The Echo of the Nazi Holocaust. in rabbinic literature. It was published by Katav Publishing Company in 1977. And beginning on, I don't know, you'd have to check Amazon. Beginning on page 333, he quotes the Tshuvot of Rav Herzog, he quotes the Tshuvot of Rav Uzio, and he goes into many of the questions that we have discussed. Above all, he goes into the Jews left behind in Russia. And here you see the depth of the problem. Right after World War II, there was a immediately following World War II, if you could prove you were not an indigenous Russian, you were able to get out. And that's when all the survivors who had been in Siberia, that you'd been a Rav, other Gedolei Yisrael, those that survived from Tel's Yeshiva, from Slabatka, many of them only survived because the communist exiled them to Siberia. You know what I'm talking about? Let me tell it to you briefly. When World War II broke out, Russia and Germany made a pact. Part of that pact was that Lithuania would be independent. All the yeshiva poured out of Poland into Lithuania. Everyone came to the Vilna area. Everyone believed, I'm telling you, what I heard from survivors, I don't have to read books about this, although today it's well documented, everyone believed that Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski would save them. And then, independent Lithuania was soon swallowed up by the communists. Now, these people faced a tremendous dilemma. Go back to Poland, the Nazis will kill you. Remain in Lithuania, the communists will abolish all religion. This is the story of the Shanghai crowd, how Mir went to Senpo Sugiharo, the Japanese consul in Kovno in Lithuania, and he gave them the ability to go to Japan, and ultimately they wind up in Shanghai for the duration of the war. Many other Jews try to get back to Poland, try to get away from Lithuania. The communists caught them, and then, just in general, when the Russians and the Nazis abrogated their treaty and declared war on one another, the Russians decided that all the Jews that are near the Polish border, they'll cooperate with the Germans, they won't be loyal citizens because they're religious, and many of them were shipped off to Siberia. And here you see, you know, God tracht und Mensch lacht. God does things and Mensch tracht und Gott lacht. That God does things, we're crying, and God is laughing. In the Memoir Literature, we read time and time again that the Jews left behind in Vilna, not shipped to Siberia, cried because of the Jews that were being shipped out. The Jews that were shipped out, if their health held out, they survived the war. And the Jews left behind were wiped out to a man. Now, he gets involved with the Russian problem. And not only that, once Russia closed its gates, the problem intensified because you had instances where Jews tried to escape from Russia. Some made it. Some didn't make it. And now you have survivors, men, women, who want to know what happened to their husbands, what happened to their wives. And here they survived the Holocaust, or they believe they survived the Holocaust. And they're trying to get out of Russia, and they never made it to the other side. Are they alive? Or are they dead? And he quotes Rav Moshe Feinstein, and next Sunday, Be'ezrat Hashem, we will begin with Rav Moshe Feinstein with an unbelievable tshuva. Now, next week, I have very, very heavyweight material to show you that Ayin Lo Ra'atah, you'll see what I did and what I collected, but leave that for next week. Yitz? be patient. I have a lot to give out.
You
have to hear me coming. Well, one second. You have to go, so 1 second.
Tomorrow morning, I can't come.
Well, what's up tomorrow? Tomorrow.
I have to go to
Here. Did you get Jewish Action?
No. Not
okay, so that's Jewish Action. This is Rav. That's Rav Weiss. This is your friend Rav Shach. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, so what did we do today? What did we do today? Baruch Hashem, we got involved with the whole question of Agunim, and I showed you the seriousness of the problem. I showed you the difference between Eidot HaMizrach and the Ashkenazim, the Chayim, the Rabbeinu Geshem, the Shvua, how it reflects Rav Herzog's Tshuvot. I introduced you to another Sefer, The Echo, by Professor Zimmels of Jews College, and it's a very fascinating topic. And you'll see next week with Reb Moshe, with Russia, and I'll show you a document next week that I brought into the world that brings it home in a very tangible, tragic fashion. I want to correct myself. Professor Shalom Rosenberg of Hebrew U, last year in passing, I mentioned Sylvia Greenfield. She's the Meretz Chavara. I don't want to go into detail now, but I mentioned she was the one that sat on that machabel and saved his life outside of Machne Yehuda. I read that in the newspapers, but it turns out that what I read was incorrect. There was a different woman with a similar background who was the one who saved the machabel. Okay. Another fascinating document that came my way from my colleague Rabbi Yeshua Grunstein, who runs the program for Rabbi Riskin of preparing student rabbis for Chutz La'aretz. He quotes something from the chief rabbi of Moscow, who quotes Rav Mordechai Tendler, who quotes Rav Moshe Feinstein, his grandson, that in the question that I've dealt with over the years, whether you were allowed to ride to shul on the metro in Moscow when there only was one shul, he quotes Rav Moshe that in 1982 Rav Moshe said, "Apilu yesh eze isa b'dava, ain chol toluta v'yetrog v'lechol basuka v'ain lahagid muma kenegdam." Bein legabe Shabbat, bein legabe Yom Tov. And he quotes Rav Moshe, and this is, assuming it's an actual quote, it's very important because, as you know, I was asked this very question in Russia, and I submitted it both to Rav Goren, chief rabbi, and to Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, and both of them asked it. So it's fascinating if this is correct.
Both of them asked
it? Both asked it. The Rav asked it and Rav Goren asked it. That you cannot use the metro to go to shul, even though they sew on the card and they can get in by showing it like this, etc., etc.
Why didn't they ask it?
That's what the Rav said. It would be mocked. There are many shadows involved. It's not so simple. But above all, the Rav and Rav Goren wanted to yell at me, scream at me, what are you, a conservative? Rav conservative? The Rav said, with all my heartache and all my understanding, but to be Matavis Bezman Hazer would open the door of conservative Judaism even wider. Okay, now, I want to go one step further. An interview appeared with me in Jewish press a week ago. And again, I didn't want to be interviewed, but I had no choice because with my new book, the OU wanted me to get some publicity and talk about the book. Anyway, I was interviewed for 2 hours, and they print a very small part of the interview. But what they print is correct. The headline was very bad. I got back from America, I'm totally jet lagged. The day I get back, and I get a call from someone named Eisen. I believe the call was from America. And he was very upset that the headline read from Lakewood to Yeshiva University. So I want to tell, if anyone knows who this Eisen is, I didn't know what he was talking about. He said he saw the article. I had no idea what he was talking about. When I saw the article and was told about it, he's absolutely right. The headline is sensationalism. I learned in Lakewood a very short period, and I was explaining why I wanted to remain in Lakewood and why I wound up in YU, but the headline, I totally disassociate myself with the headline, but I guess Jewish press has to sell newspapers. The rest of the interview, every word that was said there is me, it was perfect, there's nothing I can add or subtract, kol hakavod. So someone wrote a letter attacking what I said, particularly one question. I was asked a number of years ago, I was interviewed from some YU publication, it may be Matan interviewed me, I don't remember, years ago. And one of the questions was, why I don't wear a black hat. And I explained that my generation didn't need a black hat, it was a different generation. So the Jewish press asked me to elaborate, I explained, and you can read what I said, I think it's very nice and very respectful. So I get a letter that mamish, I'm a guy that I'm one of those Jews that wouldn't have left Egypt, I would have assimilated, I would have changed my course to go to a gentleman. I want to tell you black and white, I challenge anyone to prove to me that a black hat made in Italy, or in Israel, they bring them in cheaper ones from Hungary, is more Jewish than a baseball cap made in China. As far as I know, hundreds of thousands of Jews were tortured and killed in Hungary, and I believe Italy, Mussolini was a partner with Hitler, if my memory is not incorrect. I've yet to hear of one case of anti-Semitism in China. So, Ribbono Shel Olam, someone writes that the Jews in Mitzrayim, that wearing a baseball cap made in China, I think it's a lot better than wearing a black hat made in Italy or in Hungary. And I challenge anyone to prove me wrong. Then he goes into why I didn't attack modern orthodoxy. How many times I've seen young men davening without socks, to say nothing of wearing t-shirts. Who spoke about modern orthodoxy? What are we talking about here? But t-shirts, I have no idea what he means, t-shirts. But I can only tell you, the day that I saw this letter, I davened Minchin the Shtiblach, it was 108 degrees, I think it was the hottest day in the history of Israel. So I looked around the Minchin minyan I was davening at, you know, one minyan after another, and Katamon. So the minyan I was at, there were 17 people, about 10 of them were without socks and sandals, and all these people in sandals had beards, tzitzit out, so I don't know what to say. And a guy like me, davening without a beard, without tzitzit sticking out, Baruch Hashem, I wear socks, but I also wear orthopedic shoes, so I can't wear sandals even if I wanted to. There's a Gemara in Shabbos, Pesachim. I'm not familiar with the Gemara. You know what Gemara are you referring to?
Someone says he won't daven with sandals on, shouldn't daven, isn't allowed to daven even with shoes on.
Okay, the Seder. I hear what you're saying.
We're afraid of means.
Yeah, it could be Gemara. Then he refers to Reb Heschel Shechter's story about the jacket on Shabbos, and I can only tell you about that story and the hat story. I challenged the person who wrote the letter to ask a member of the Rabbi Soloveitchik's family if they consider these stories true. Okay? I'm not going to comment further. Then the final comment, which I was blown away, was he says, yes, I'm right that in Lakewood, when I was in Lakewood, there were no black hats, there were no blah, 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 because then, listen to this, that this was a function of the fact that there was little need to separate Jews from others. Discrimination accomplished that. And he says, but today, we don't have discrimination. The situation changed over the years, and the dress code changed accordingly. I just want to state the following. I'm the first one in the world to admit the dress code changed. I'm the first one in the world to admit that your generation probably needs black hats to keep you Jewish. Discrimination? I grew up in the 40s into the 50s. I just spent 5.5 weeks touring the entire East Coast, Washington, Baltimore, New York, Long Island. Gentlemen, when I grew up, there was no anti-Semitism whatsoever. The Jews were respected. Today, the anti-Semitism, the New York Times, the hatred, the enmity, the Muslims. What are you talking about? Okay, so I just wanted to respond to that letter, but I'm telling everyone in advance that's the last letter I respond to, because in this world I've learned long ago If a Jew says it's night, another Jew says it's day, I say this, he says that, but read what I wrote, read what I said. I believe I was respectful, I was upright, I was decent. Finally, I call your attention, a student of mine evidently didn't hear what I said, but he said it so beautifully, word by word, what I said. This is a blog from Rabbi Steve Przenski, my dear student. And he was enjoying the beauty, he writes beautifully. He was in St. Moritz several weeks ago, he's living a good life. When he was informed of another breach of the Masorah that occurred under ostensibly Orthodox auspices, a woman as prayer leader in the synagogue. And he goes on dealing with what happened in Riverdale. So I want to tell you, I've often said, when I was invited to give a shiur in Chovevei Torah, I told them, remember my answer? Invite me in 50 years and I'll give you an answer. I have to see what's going to develop here, but I have my fears. But open-minded, give us 50 years. I have to tell you very sadly, in my humble opinion, the 50 years have ended and it's a new form of conservative Judaism, just developing before our eyes. I understand why it developed, everyone explains to me, and it's a counter-reaction. NYU and the swing to the right, and I've heard 101 explanations, but it doesn't matter. My hands shake when I think what's happening. And it started here, it's now Copycat, and it's now Riverdale, Trisha, it'll soon be on Pico Boulevard in Los Angeles, and with our own eyes, it's a replay of 1910 all over again. I lived it then in my research, and I'm living it again in reality. And I want to salute Rabbi Przenski. I have to say, his article, magnificent, he writes beautifully. Gentlemen, I wouldn't miss tomorrow's Shayua for all the rice in China. Be'ezrat Hashem. We're sailing right into contemporary problems. This year is very, very special. We begin with Reform Conservative, and then we come into the big leagues, Holocaust, Zionism, Das Terra, and all that goes with it. So I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for coming. If anyone wants Rabbi Przenski's blog, if anyone wants a copy of the letter to the editor, you are welcome to it. If we meet again, health and happiness. Das Vidanya. Thank you. David, 9 o'clock tomorrow.
901.
What?
901.
901. The Seder.
I don't know.